BCFM, community radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Hello, and welcome to this week's Radio Dialect. Dialect is back on air after the summer break. The show is coming to you from Bristol City Centre and is part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. This week we have an interview from the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, an item on the Scottish Peace Movement, Lisa Braden interviews Oliver Millingham at the Lansdowne Pub Theatre about his new play Another Time, Another Place, and we meet up with Gary Carpenter from Clevedon, who is the youngest and fastest person to swim the English Channel. Jeff will be here later on for the latest in What's On Around Bristol. I'm Diane Lukins, presenter of this week's show, and I've just joined the Dialect team with Mark Condon, who is our engineer. Now over to John Peters Coleman for the news.
Bus operator First has announced a series of bus fare increases in the Bristol area. The company intends to start the new 6% price increase on Sunday, the 31st of August. A spokesman for First said, "Following constantly increasing cost of fuel, we are changing the costs of most fares. To help our customers with the cost of travel, we have introduced new fares and promotions." David Sedgwell, spokesperson for the Campaign for Better Transport, called on the area's unity authorities, Bristol City, North Somerset and South Gloucestershire councils to subsidise fares. He said, "The price rise will mean a small percentage of people who can't afford the new fares will walk, cycle or take their cars again. Unless there is an integrated transport authority, the local authority will not get people out of their cars." A local railway action group is hoping to reinstate the former rail link between Portishead and Bristol. North Somerset have spent £75,000 on acquiring this piece of land from the British Railways Board. The leader of North Somerset Council, Nigel Ashton, said he was delighted that we have finally got the government to look at the viability of the Portishead rail link. However, there is no evidence to date that the government intends to reconsider its previous white paper decision to decline investment in the Portishead to Bristol Railway. The government declared this year that it does not see the reopening of the line as a priority. A consultation by the company Halcro has indicated that the proposed link is feasible, but the council has already stated it could not finance the project without the help of central government funding. The current freight train from Portbury to Bristol would also need upgrading to meet safety regulations for a new passenger link. There are fears from some local people that lack of funds from central government could force the local authority to use the available land to sell off to developers for housing to raise much needed income, rather than to use it to reinstate the old rail link. Bristol is entering the Clean Britain Award, which will be announced next year at the award ceremony at the NEC Birmingham on the 10th of March 2009. South Gloucestershire Council is entering the competition for the first time. Areas of the city will be assessed at random and judged on a visitor's point of view. The criteria includes first impressions, litter, rubbish and fly tipping, chewing gum deposits and dog fouling, signage and street furniture cleanliness, unauthorised graffiti and overgrown and obstructing hedgerows on pavements. The object of the awards is to provide cleanliness recognition for both the custodians of public places and the people who use them through the development of a sense of civic pride and respect for the environment in which people live, work or visit throughout the UK. Bristol Poetry Festival starts on the 4th of September and runs until the 14th of September at venues across the city. The festival aims to bring together the most entertaining, inspirational and award-winning poets and performers from not only Bristol and the South West, but also from the UK and elsewhere, in an annual celebration of language, imagination and life. It's on the 6th of September at the Arnold Feeney at 8pm. Specifically, there will be a poetry slam when Bristol takes on Liverpool. And if you want to book tickets for that, contact the Arnold Feeney box office on 0117 917 2300. Or you can log on to their website, festival at poetrycan.co.uk. You can email them. You can also email boxoffice@arnolfini.org.uk. Look out for the festival of ideas, starting on the 3rd of September and finishing in October at venues around the city.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Thank you, John. Now, our first feature this evening is about the Scottish Peace Movement. Reporter Anthea Page met Janet Fenton, coordinator at the Edinburgh Peace and Justice Centre, on a recent trip to the Edinburgh Fringe.
I'm Janet Fenton, and I'm the coordinator of the Edinburgh Peace and Justice Centre.
Can you tell us about your work in Edinburgh?
Yeah, the Peace and Justice Centre has been here since 1980, and it's concerned with networking between different organisations and individuals that are concerned with peace and justice issues. I've been involved in peace activity for a long time. I'm a member of Trident Ploughshares. I do direct action. And I'm a member of Scottish CND. I've been active with Stop the War in the past as well, and other groups. I used to run a charity called Evergreen, which was about looking at the links between environmental responsibility and resources and peace and all of these things, because like a lot of people, I think they're all very interconnected. I also regard myself as a feminist, which is also, I think, an important part of the whole thing.
What about the Scottish Government's role with regard to Stop the War campaign?
Well, I think that the Scottish Government position is very different since the most recent election, and I feel quite hopeful, because I think we've now got a government that is reflecting the views of the ordinary people of Scotland, and that is very much that we take a very strong position, particularly about nuclear weapons. The vast majority of people in Scotland understand that nuclear weapons do nothing except make us a target, and the illegal invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq has increased the likelihood of that target coming under attack, and we just want absolutely no part of that. And we've now got a government that a year ago, last June, there was a vote put to the Parliament, and although defence is a reserved issue, there was a very strong vote in the Scottish Parliament, and not even the Labour Party in Scotland, the Labour Party weren't able to produce a single MSP that was willing to vote with Tony Blair's view on that white paper. So Scotland is united against nuclear weapons, and we've now got a government that hopefully will be prepared to act on that.
So
the Calman Commission, which is just coming up, is looking to see what matters should and shouldn't be reserved to Scotland. And while the Calman Commission obviously can't look at independence, because it's something that's set up to look at how devolution is working rather than whether we should have it or not. But one of the things that we're very much hoping that the Calman Commission will do is look at the issue of weapons of mass destruction, and consider whether or not it's in the best interests of Scotland for the control of those to be held from Westminster.
So can the Scottish Government influence Westminster anyway?
Well, I would hope they can. I would hope that if you're in a position where the vast majority of people in the country and the established civic society through all the major churches, trade unions, and other representative bodies are all taking a very strong position that say that the people in Scotland don't want the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan, they don't want nuclear weapons, they don't want that terrible, wicked waste of resources, We would hope that the Westminster government would pay some attention, because if they don't, they're going to lose their seats.
So what about links with other Stop the War campaigns in Britain? Do you have any links?
Yes, with the Peace and Justice Centre in Edinburgh is now, it was originally just a local, very much a resource base for people in Edinburgh, but it has grown. And there were a number of ecumenical centres set up in 1980, but I think that we're the one that remains. And we're very much part of a thing called Scotlands for Peace. So we do work on a national level as far as that's concerned. But additionally, we have links all over, not just in England and in other parts of the UK, but we feel we always need to be raising our eyes to the hills. So we do have very strong links with Stop the War and other movements for peace in this country, in England and overseas and in the States. And I think that it's important to remember that while we may have very strong views about the government of the US, there are a large number of ordinary people that are very active for peace and that are very much opposed to the war. And the new technology and the long-term connections that we've had will enable us to make best use of this. One of the things that the Peace and Justice Centre is engaged in is looking at an international seminar which we're co-hosting with Trident Ploughshares and with the Acronym Institute. And that will be a seminar in February to look at Scotland's obligations under international law. And we're hoping to have some very high-powered people from coming a long way for that conference. I can't actually give you names at this stage, but...
So if anyone wants to get involved with the seminar, is there a contact number or website they can log on to?
Yes, there's a number of different ways of contacting the Peace and Justice Centre or Trident Ploughshares or the Acronym Institute. And if you just Google any of those names, you'll soon find us. But we're peaceandjustice.org.uk. And we're actually slightly embarrassed by our website because we've just got a new one and it's kind of a bit in the throes of construction at the moment. So it looks very out of date, but that's because we've only put old stuff on it so far. But that hopefully over the next couple of weeks it'll be improving.
Thanks very much.
That was Anthea Page talking to Janet Fenton at the Edinburgh Peace and Justice Centre. Now for some music.
Go!
That was It's a Long Way to the Top If You Want to Rock and Roll by AC/DC. Chris Ironside from Brislington has written a collection of short stories for Radio Dialect. This one, read by yours truly, is all about an agony aunt. Per Petrella Bluebell wrote the agony column for the local paper. She was a dear, sweet soul under her pale, over-rimmed glasses and her worldly air. Beside her on the desk as she typed and read her letters was a large box of tissues. She was frequently in tears. "Oh, it's such a sad, sad world," she would often say, with an enormous tear rolling down her long mouse nose and onto her cheek, plopping gently in a little splash on her paper or elsewhere on her desk. Then, in a rather masculine way, to hide her embarrassment, she would blow her nose and pretend she had a cold coming on. She didn't want to earn the reputation of being a bit blubbery, but actually, it was very revealing of her good nature, and a first-class qualification for being an agony aunt after all. Although the paper did not want it known that she cried so much, who would want a counsellor in that position who didn't? Her replies in the paper were wise, diplomatic, and a real education in psychology, and how to get yourself out of some emotional scrapes. She did not want to dress in dark materials and wore clothes that were brightly dyed in pink or turquoise. She also liked yellow, especially on her quieter or more thoughtful days. In the summer, she wore shiny raincoats and skirts with large polka dots or minuscule ones. Often, in front of her on the desk, were the latest psychology magazines and large tomes to do with the subject. She generally knew her stuff, and many people in her column were helped to know how to send away the undesirable, unpleasant people they came across. Other problems, too many to relate, were handled by her expert common sense and compassionate wisdom. Sometimes, though not often, she would ring the person concerned to fill out the details, offer more appropriate help more directly, and her genuine concern travelled across telecommunication systems like the feeling you get when warm bath salts or bubbles exude your senses with pretty colours and smells. But her skill was the gentle, soothing words in her replies to those who wrote to her in heartbroken dilemmas or in various degrees of plight.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Is from the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. One of the most entertaining shows this year was Secret Agents, based on the novel by Joseph Conrad. The play centres on an alleged plot to blow up the London Eye. Our reporter Anthea Page went behind the scenes to meet the director.
Well, I'm at the Edinburgh Festival and I'm here talking to Michael about your production, your company. Can you tell us a bit more about it, please?
Yeah, the play is called Secret Agents. Our company's called Apicorus, and it's a play about conspiracy theories, urban myths, terrorists, counter-terrorism, and a lot of jazz. The idea kind of came together. We did a few workshops around urban myths and conspiracy theories and that whole sort of post 9/11 paranoia of, we focused on one particular one, which was the conspiracy theory that there'd been an attempt to blow up the London Eye.
Well, where did you get that from?
Just off the internet. There's a clip on YouTube that you can see. If you go to YouTube and go to London Eye Bomb or something like that, or Who Blew Up the London Eye, things like that, and you'll find very shonkily made, very dodgy looking footage supposedly of a pod blowing up on the London Eye. So we used that as a kind of story, and then we took in Joseph Conrad's novel The Secret Agent, which is about counter-terrorism in the years before the First World War, which at that time there were lots of political anarchist groups, kind of like offshoots from hard left communist groups as well, who were basically doing really low level terrorist attacks in London. And so that's why Conrad wrote the novel then, saying that he, you know, and the dynamic in the novel is that the counter-terrorists have so deeply infiltrated the terrorist groups that they're actually basically being the terrorists themselves.
So a bit like people believe is happening to David.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the kind of thing that we wanted to sort of tread the line between the sort of conspiracy theory views of, you know, governments being behind everything and the fact that there is some sort of accidental government culpability and things like that. One of the examples we use is French Secret Service giving training to Algerian Secret Service, and then Algerian Secret Service having counter-terrorists infiltrate terrorist groups operating in Algeria, and then the counter-terrorist infiltrators being so enthusiastic and geared up that they're actually promoting terrorist attacks themselves.
Like Pakistan and the terrorists, you know, they trained people who then turned into the terrorists.
Oh yeah, like the Americans and CIA trained the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, things like that. Yeah. But this was more what's funny in inverted commas about this is just the kind of hapless accidentalness of it. There's this guy who'd been a particular guy who was working for Algerian Secret Service, and he had been he'd been told, like, you know, his mission was to go in and be really, really zealous, you know, and try and find out what's going on. He was basically sort of turned into like their most prolific terrorist, and he was being, they didn't have any
just
money.
Can't beat them, join them.
Yeah, and this little cell didn't have any money, and they didn't even really, they barely even existed in any sort of reasonable way. And the French were giving this guy all this money, and he was then using the money to sort of fund the terrorism, which he would then sort of, you know, was going to blow the lid on. But you can either think it's a sort of great duplicitous plot, but the line that we sort of take in the play is that it's sort of human accident and, yeah, you know, miscommunication and people just trying to get. That's our lead character, Burlock, played by Will, who's sitting there, is just really. Maybe Will can probably describe him better than I can.
He's as Mike says, incredibly hapless. He's basically a shabby drunkard whose real passions in life are kind of drinking in the bars of Soho and the bars of the world and jazz.
The jazz? Does it go with drunken, hapless people or not?
Not necessarily, no. I mean, that was kind of... I mean, the thing is, I came to the part after it had been already devised by Michael and the other two actors and another guy last year. So it was kind of ready-made when I got here, but I mean, I think his nature basically has meant that he's kind of stumbled into this world. Basically, he kind of, in the play we've said it, that he's kind of wandering around Casablanca in kind of, you know, jazz bars and also in Berlin, and he kind of picks up weird information in seedy nightclubs and kind of eventually falls into handing that information on to certain government officials for a small fee, probably to fund further drinking
and
more jazz, the acquisition of more rare John Coltrane albums, and then kind of slowly that develops into kind of being a trusted spy for the Russians, but also at the same time being a spy for the Americans as well. That kind of develops, and he becomes this kind of an agent provocateur in the employ of Her Majesty's government in England.
The idea behind the jazz as well was when we were doing the first workshops was in January 2007, and I just actually had this jazz CD that was playing again and again in the car, and I've been just we'd done the first workshops and done the first scratch night, and thinking that Verloc's character is quite in the secret agent novel by Conrad, he's not very sympathetic. He's one of those characters that Conrad writes, which is a real empty space. And although you hear a lot about Verloc, you don't get to learn very much about him. And although that kind of works in literature really nicely, written literature, it didn't seem, it sort of be a bit empty on the stage. And seeing as the whole play was going to reflect Verloc's personality, the way we were doing it, he needed to have a personality to reflect. And listening to this jazz and just began to sort of formulate the idea that if, you know, what was the most opposite thing from from science, you know, this kind of clinical scientific way of the world. It's like jazz has to be just the absolute antithesis to science. And that's
it immediately puts you into the atmosphere of Soho and this sort of seedy nightclubs and where people go and they don't know everyone else to start off with and then they gradually build up their little gang. But what about the autistic person who is the bomber, becomes the bomber by accident? Well, he doesn't know he's the bomber, does he, really?
No, he does.
Why pick on an autistic person?
That's in the Conrad's novel. That's
autistic.
He doesn't go. He doesn't describe. I mean, he's a sort of early 20th century language, so I don't think he calls him autistic. So that's the plot of the original, and again, why I wanted to stick with that. We did talk a little bit about whether we did or didn't want to stick with that. And we're thinking, I saw some footage of a young bomber he wasn't in the Gaza Strip, but he was going to go to the Gaza Strip, and they were presumably going somewhere in Israel. It's like a sort of 13, 14-year-old kid, and he's being interviewed. And he's sitting there in the interview with the bomb on. It was like, I can't remember, it was some sort of Channel 4 kind of interviews with terrorists. And the kid was clearly, the footage was like sitting there, maybe he was brainwashed or something. But he just seemed that, seemed a bit confused and a bit of an innocent and didn't really know exactly what was going on. Didn't he have like a conception of a specific conception or a developed conception of life and death?
Yeah. So these are the people they're targeting, the people who are a bit vulnerable and can't really.
But Verla doesn't target him. That's the thing as well. That's why we liked. It's a setup that looks like terrorists very carefully and clinically and cynically target people who are vulnerable. But again, in our story, it's all just haphazard accident. It just happens that this is his brother-in-law. It just happens that his brother-in-law's heard some of what they're discussing. It just happens that the sister is, the wife is putting pressure anyway, regardless, for them to develop a relationship. And those are all things that come from the novel as well.
Oh, right.
So we wanted to get away from the idea of there being any plan. There's no plan.
Yeah.
Like jazz.
I thought it was excellent. You just remind people again what the play's called? And you might be touring, mightn't you?
Yes, we'd absolutely love to come to Bristol. And we'd love to come to Bath. And if anyone there listening owns a theatre in Bristol or Bath, we'd gladly come down. We want to tour. The play's called Secret Agents. Company's called Apicorus Theatre Company. We've got a website, www.apicorus.co.uk, and we'd love to tour it after Edinburgh. That's the big idea.
Well, good luck the rest of the festival.
Thank you so much. Thanks a lot.
Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us, above us only sky. Imagine all the people living for today. Imagine there's no countries. It isn't hard to do. Nothing to kill or die for, and no religion too. Imagine all the people living life in peace. You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us, and the world will be as one. Thank you. imagine no possessions. I wonder if you can. No need for greed or hunger. A brotherhood of man. Imagine all the people sharing all the world. Oh, you may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you will join us. The world will leave us one. Imagine.
That was Imagine by Antonio Banderas. This week in the poetry slot, I'm going to read a poem by John Donne. It's called The Flea. Mark but this flea, and mark in this, how little that which thou deniest me is. It sucked me first, and now sucks thee. And in this flea our two bloods mingled be. Thou knowest that this cannot be said, a sin, nor shame, nor loss of maidenhead. Yet this enjoys before it woo, and pampered swells with one blood made of two. And this, alas, is more than we would do. O stay three lives in one flea spare, where we almost, nay, more than married are. This flea is you and I, and this our marriage bed and marriage temple is, though parents grudge and you were met and cloistered in these living walls of jet. Though use make you apt to kill me, let not to that self-murder added be, and sacrilege three sins in killing three. Cruel and sudden hast thou since purpled thy nail in blood of innocence. In what could this flea guilty be, except in that drop which it sucked from thee? Yet thou triumphst, and sayest that thou findest not thyself, nor me the weaker now. 'Tis true, then, learn how false fears be. Just so much honour, when thou yield'st to me, will waste as this flea's death took life from thee.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Jeff Sparks is back in the studio with his guide to What's On in the week ahead.
Good evening. This is your What's On guide from Dialect Radio. Kicking off with Friday, 5th of September, at the Reckless Engineer in Bristol, AFGM will be performing. The gigs will start around 9 p.m. Also on 5th of September and at the Rolleston, which is at 73 Commercial Road in Swindon, Alien Stash Tin will be performing. The gig will start around 9 p.m. and entry is free. Now I come to Song of the Week, and I feature the ex-Skid Row singer Sebastian Bach. The album Angel Down was released in 2007, and the track I'll be playing is titled Back in the Saddle, which was originally performed by Aerosmith. Now I will mention that Bach's version of the song features Guns N' Roses singer Axl Rose. So here is Back in the Saddle from the album Angel Down.
Thank you.
Sebastian Bach with Back in the Saddle from his latest album Angel Down. Moving on to Saturday 6th of September, and at the Croft in Bristol, the Horrors will be performing a DJ set. Support comes from HTRK and also Saturation Point. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £5 on the door. Also on 6th of September, Thomas Applin and the Thief will be performing with support at Mr. Wolf's in Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £3 on the door. Finally, on to Sunday 7th of September, and at the Fleece in Bristol, G Baby I Love You will be performing. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £8 in advance. That is all from me tonight. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you, Jeff. Last week, the Lansdowne Pub in Clifton hosted its first drama event called Upstairs at the Lansdowne with a new play, Another Time, Another Place, written and directed by Oliver Millingham. Dialect's reporter, Lisa Braden, met Oliver after the show to discuss his new play.
Hello, my name's Oliver Millingham, and together with Alan Coveney, Paul Nicholson, Sarah Bobby and Sam Mullinson, we've started some theatre upstairs at the Lansdowne. Our first play is written specifically for the space, and it's called Another Time, Another Place. The whole project began about a year and a half ago when I was I've been coming to this pub for about 3 years. About a year and a half ago, I thought how amazing it would be to have theatre upstairs. And so, after working at the tobacco factory doing the Shakespeare season, I thought of using the room in the round, and it came to a peak in August.
That's a really nice sort of intimate venue, isn't it? I really enjoyed it. What I particularly liked was the juxtaposition. You've got really high romance. It was so romantic. I thought, God, I wish a blue would be like that with me. And you've got the pathos, and then you've got humour and irony. Just what gave you the inspiration for the play?
The play itself came from looking at that man in the pub, sitting on his own and what he thinks about, really.
And I am that man in the pub. My name is Paul Nicholson, and I play the part of Paul, the older man, who comes here every year to celebrate, if celebrate's the right word, an evening that ended in disaster for his girlfriend, and indeed himself.
How did you get involved with Oliver?
I know Oliver from the tobacco factory.
Right.
We were both in the last Shakespeare season, so I was any actor's pleased to work, so I was very pleased when he offered me a role.
And I was equally
in
delighted.
His first play.
And I was equally delighted.
Yeah, we mustn't let this turn into mutual admiration.
No, of course not.
We're just two jobbing actors. Always available for work.
Yes, you can give your contact details at the end, thank you. A person commented that she thought it was too short. I thought it was perfectly timed. Because to me, it was like a slice of life, like still life. And yes. that was enough. I mean, there was an awful lot encapsulated in it.
Yes, I think a play dictates its own length.
Yes.
It really isn't quantity. Its quality. In fact, it was a longer play, but we've honed it and taken out lines that didn't work or didn't carry on to the next scene or the next speech. With all due respect to Oliver, there was a lot of extraneous matter in it.
Oh, completely.
Which we've eased out, and that to the betterment of the play. And
it is a
very good piece. it's a very strong piece, I feel. Because we have made it in some respect shorter.
Well, what happened? It was written over the 2nd and 3rd of August, which sounds brief, but it was on the 1st episode, this is going to happen. And then I called Paul on Sunday and said, Paul, are you free for a few weeks? And he said, well, Oliver, let me see the space and let me see the play. And then on Monday we looked at the play with Alan and Paul. And then we worked on the Tuesday. And ever since then it's been about honing the script to make it clear, to make the stories, the journeys clear, and to make sure that we're revealing information at just the right time, so it's not a barrage of it.
I found it quite sort of self-evident, sorry to interrupt you there, that you were the young Paul. That came across to me very clearly, and I thought that was brilliant the way that was sort of illustrated.
It was it was lovely because we set it in real time. Mm. It was lovely to have the luxury of... Or even the luxury, no, that doesn't make sense. But to have the luxury of the space and be able to adapt the script as we wished, so we could put that scene overlapping with the Paul and Alan scene.
I think the most amazing thing about the piece is the fact that the room plays an important part. Mm. I mean, the play started with the room, and the room, in many respects, is the main character.
Yes, along with the table and
with,
two chairs.
Yes, with its memories of past occasions.
And the other thing I like is very sort of symbiotic when you're both at the mirror and you're both pouring the wine, you're both saying the same thing.
The two worlds in
yes, I really yes, I, that really came across.
That's what I call good theatre.
Absolutely.
Perhaps I shouldn't have been in it, but that is what theatre is made of, magic moments.
Well,
and
yes.
I hope that is one of them.
Oh, absolutely. I'm so glad I came, and thank you very much for the tickets. Could you give some details about where people can get tickets from and contact details, please?
Certainly. Our booking line is 07909502906. Our show actually runs until the 28th of August, so it's only on for another 2 days. However, we anticipate that this won't be the last production, in fact, it will be the first of many in this new theatre venue, and
anticipate that our next production will be in October, to be finalised. But yes, we're hoping that this will become a new venue for theatre.
Well, I certainly hope so too. Thank you very much, Oliver Millingham. This is Lisa Braden for Radio Dialect. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Congratulations to Team GB for achieving a record number of gold medals for Britain in the Olympics. And a young swimmer from Clevedon has achieved his own record. Gary Carpenter is the youngest and fastest person ever to swim the English Channel. He talks to our reporter about his achievement.
I'm down at Clevedon. I'm sitting on the beach and I'm here with Gary Carpenter. Now, you're the youngest person ever to swim the Channel, is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
And when did you do this?
26th of August last year, 2007.
And what was today? There was a special event today?
It's a year, basically a year to the day that I was swimming, so I was still swimming at the moment, a year ago, and they just presented me with a plaque on the Clevedon Pier to say well done and just commemorate it, I think.
So what made you decide to swim the Channel?
An accident, really. It was a guy called Steve Price, my coach, who helped me through the Bristol Channel swim, said I came back from doing a English Channel relay team, and he asked me, so what's your next swim? And then I thought he was saying a joke when he said, how about the Bristol Channel? And I said yes, thinking he was joking. But he wasn't, and about 2 days later he rang me up and said, "Oh right, well, get down the lake then, you've got an English Bristol Channel to swim." So that was basically an accident by saying yes.
Oh, so are you in the Guinness Book of Records?
No, I'm not. Will
you be?
I'm not sure. I don't know how we go around doing anything like that, but no, not at the moment.
How do you prepare to swim the channel? Do you need a lot of backup support?
Yeah, a lot of backup support.
Can you tell us what happens if you decide to swim the channel? I mean, do you have rowers going behind you to make sure that you do it, you know, you're not in danger at all?
You have a main pilot boat, which is which goes by next to you. It's always next to you, always as close as it can get anyway, or a certain distance away. So if you get in any trouble, it'll come and help you out. And then there's a little boat that goes with it, like a little dinghy boat with a motor on it, that if you really do need feeding and things like that, then that gets it, that gives you the bottle and everything, and you have a drink from it and carry on swimming.
So how long did it take you altogether?
5 hours, 35 and 25 seconds.
And was there a big reception team waiting for you in France? A lot of French people cheering you on or not?
What? For the English Channel? Channel was...
Where did you start from? Dover?
Dover to Calais, yeah.
Was there a lot of French people in Calais when you got there?
No, there was...
They didn't know you were doing it?
No, there's so many people do it that... I mean, on that day there was six teams doing it. And
really?
Two solo people. So it was... there's a lot of, obviously, holiday makers and things like that on the beach, but they didn't know what we were doing.
So you choose a really calm day then? You wait for it to be really calm before you attempt it?
Yeah. I mean, with the Bristol Channel, if it's choppy inshore, it'll be very choppy in the middle. Even if it's calm, if it's fairly calm inshore, it can still be very choppy in the middle. So you've got to get the perfect day, which what I had.
What about boats? Because it's very busy, the channel. Were you worried about having an accident with a boat, then not seeing you? Or?
No, because when we set off, you always tell the lifeguard, coast guards, that you're doing a channel swim, and they'll tell all boats around. And I trust my coach and my pilot who was on the boat. I trust them to be able to point me in the right direction and stop me if there is a boat coming.
Were you scared?
Not scared. I don't really get scared. It was nerve-wracking standing, waiting for the swim to start. But it was very nerve-wracking.
You can give at any time, can't you?
Yeah.
Because you've got the support boat.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I got in the water, and it's like, my parents know this, that it's very hard for somebody to try and get me out of the water. Like, I want to stay in and carry on doing the swim, and if I was in trouble, the coach would have said I would have had to get out, but I really wouldn't have wanted to get out, because I trained like 2 years doing this.
So you're the youngest person ever to swim the channel, yeah?
Yes.
So what age are you?
Now I'm 17. I was 16 when I did it, which my coach held the previous record for the fastest as well, which I managed to take off him, which I was very pleased about. But
So it's like two wins in one almost.
Yeah. I think it was something like 20 years gap, or somewhere around there, that between me and my coach, who managed to hold the record for a long time.
So what's the next challenge?
I really don't know. A lot of people have said that.
Olympic swimming?
No, there's a lot of better people out there than I am. A lot of faster people. I went to do a nationals the other day, and there was a lot of fast people out there, and they were finishing very, very, very quick. I don't know, I want to do the Bristol Channel again. I've said I will do it, And a lot of people have said, are you going to do the double? Are you going to do the English channel on your own? And I really don't know. I just have to wait and see.
Yeah. Well, congratulations anyway. And thank great you. Achievement.
That was Gary Carpenter talking to Anthea Page. That's the end of this week's Radio Dialect show from the Radio Bristol Co-op, based in the city centre. In today's studio were John Peters Coleman, who read the news, a new team member, Mark Condon, engineered the show. Jess Spartz gave us the weekly guide to what's on. Chris Ironside from Brislington wrote the short story. Reporting and producing were Lisa Braden and Anthea Page. You can download the show on the internet at www.dialectradio.co.uk. So that's a goodbye from everyone here at Radio Dialect and from me, Diane Lukins, presenter of this week's show. Until next week, goodbye.